This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Recollections Radio. Monday morning tea time is now all about sharing memories with you, old and new, of life in Dunedin.
Bringing you stories, interviews and music from times past and inviting you to share your memories with us.
Presented by Jill Bowie and Kay Mercer, the team behind Dunedin Public Library's Scattered Seeds Archive. Thanks to generous funding by the New Zealand Libraries Partnership Project.
Recollections Radio, Monday mornings at 11 on 105.4 FM and 1575 AM.
Kia ora!
Morena.
How is everyone? Hope you're having a great day. Sad day because it's obviously the day of the Queen's funeral. So our thoughts are with anyone who's feeling sad today because of that. But hopefully we can cheer you up a wee bit with some lovely music and some chat about the various projects and things that we've got going in the Scattered Seeds Digital Archive at Dunedin Public Libraries.
Yeah, it's a bit chilly out there this morning.
Yeah. It's chilly. I'm very cold.
Yeah.
But we'll soon warm you up. We'll be doing some dancing. Talking of dancing, Dance Hall Project. We've been working on our Dance Hall Project, collecting lots of lovely memories from people around the city who can recall going to the dance halls in their younger days, or well, not so younger days, many of the dances that they would have prepared for by going to dance lessons and enjoying a great night on a Friday and Saturday and sometimes during the week, I believe.
Yes.
So we've had lots of chats with people, and we've got lots of material going up on our archive. So if you want to have a look at that and recall some of those wonderful times, it's www.dunedin.recollect.co.nz.
Yes.
And if you have some memories you'd like to share with us, we really want to hear from you, as we've said before. So please do email us, library@dcc.govt.nz, or call us on 03474 3690 and ask for Jill or Kay in the library, and we'll get back to you. And or you can just pop into the library and talk to one of the librarians and leave your details, and we'll give you a call.
And I was talking to my mother last night about, because sometimes we've heard that people have been to the St Kilda dances, they went on during the week as well, but I was talking to my mother last night and she definitely went on a Saturday night, so they must have, the town hall and the St Kilda dance must be crossed over as well, so we'd like to know more about that as well.
Well, I think the town hall was so heavily used that probably there was space, there was capacity for other dances to be happening at the same time. And certainly there were other dance bands. We've talked to people from two or three different dance bands who played for those. So, it was a real happening time.
Yeah, it really was.
Wonderful to hear. Yeah. I've been having a look at some of the principles and practice of dancing the night away. This is from an article written in New Zealand Geographic about the dance halls in 2005. So we're way behind the times with our investigation. But this was really interesting. It's an article written by Georgina White, and I've just picked out some elements from it. She says, a dance was one of the most important opportunities for single men and women to meet. We have certainly verified that with our conversations with people, yeah. And it was a chance for the community to get together. Dancing would be an inexpensive form of entertainment. It's quite cheap to go. Whether you dance the foxtrot or you waltzed, for single men and women all over the country, going to a dance was fundamentally about meeting someone of the opposite sex. Numerous letters in archive collections identify a dance as the starting point for a lifelong relationship, and that's certainly the reason you set this project up, isn't
beautiful.
It, Jill? In the 1840s, way back then, two social dance traditions reached New Zealand shores. They were the invitation-only ball and the ticketed public dance. In February 1849, the Otago News advertised a single fete and ball to promote communal hilarity and concord in Dunedin. Lots of that going on.
And that communal hilarity.
Yes, I think we should have more communal hilarity and concord. Saloons and hotels advertise weekly dancing in the local newspapers, and the Harvest Home, a celebration at a farmer's homestead of the local harvest, was particularly popular in Otago. Throughout the country, there were also committee-organised public dances to which gentlemen could buy single or double tickets if they were lucky. Committees came from organisations such as the Mechanics Institute or the Freemasons, or were made up of local single men and women. And the dancers then being called bachelor's balls or spinster's balls accordingly. And this is the bit I like. To keep costs down, hosts would opt to serve just tea with bread and butter at supper time. Hence, they were called bread and butter balls. A feature common to all these events, though, was a lack of ladies. And as a result, wallflowers were originally male.
Ah, really?
Yeah. Men arrived early to secure names on their dance cards and occasionally requested women to split dances between partners because they needed to spread themselves around a bit. For women, being in the minority was exhausting. Yes, I can imagine. While men hoped for a partner, women hoped most probably for a rest.
Just want to sit down.
Indeed. Yeah. So that's that. I'll talk more about the balls later.
Yeah.
Yeah. So over to you.
Over the weekend, I also had a bit of a busy weekend, sort of running around town. So yesterday at the library, we hosted Val McDermid and Michael Robotham and JP Palmieri in conversation with Vanda Simon. So that was fantastic. So we were so lucky to get them. So if you haven't read any of their books, I highly recommend them. They're great. Group of people that obviously are hilarious as well. Those van rides must be great. But I also went to the Kaleidoscope World Exhibition down at the Hocken again. I thought I'd get into one last viewing before it closes on the 24th of September. And I was looking at the big map that Robert Scott drew of all the venues around Dunedin. And I was interested in Chippendale House, which was off up Stafford Street. The building's still there, but it was interesting because I hadn't really heard about it as a, you know, as a music venue. But Richard Langston wrote an article in Audio Culture about it. So Richard Langston has a nice relationship with our Scattered Seeds archive because he is on it, he's written poetry on it, and his family members are on it as well. So yeah, so Chippendale House, so that was just a short walk up Stafford Street. But they didn't serve alcohol there, so you sort of had to stop off somewhere else. So it was, and it's, he says, it often paid to drink something more warming than beer anyway, especially in winter, because a pot-belly stove glowed white while trying to keep the place warm. But yeah, it was a place started by artists for artists, and loads of people played there. And so it started in 1985 and closed down in 87. So a collective ran it, and so they had poets, painters, theatre groups, bands there as well.
Sounds ideal.
Yeah, it was great. Amazing. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, because it says, the Chippendales' problem was always money, not performances. It started with an arts grant from the QE2 Arts Council of $10,000, and the likes of Michael Morley, David Kilgour and Stella Corkery were employed under a PEP scheme to organise and run the place. Yeah, gigs had to be staged to raise cash to keep the place afloat, to pay basic bills, the rent and gas bill, as often the case with such venues, the energy to keep it going just sort of ran out. So the lease was terminated on the January 14th, 1988.
So sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
That musicians and other artists, other visual and audio artists, have to work so hard, not just at their art, the rehearsals and performances, but to just raise money to pay themselves.
Keep
it's
going.
Crazy. I just heard on the radio this morning that, I think it was, I can't remember which radio station it was listening to, but Ireland has set up a scheme now where they're paying musicians £500, Irish pounds, I guess. Do they have pounds? I don't know. Anyway, £500 a week to live on while they entertain the masses. And, you know, it was always in the olden days, back in the medieval times and before that, musicians were valued.
Yes.
And for, you know, for carrying on the traditions and the oral stories and just the social effect that they had. And I think it's a great shame that they're not these days. So go Ireland.
Yes.
What I say.
Yeah, and go out and support, you know, local bands and art here in Dunedin as well.
So indeed.
Keep them going.
Indeed. Now, we had a lovely time interviewing Jim Strang, who is the son of Harry Strang. I can't remember who it was. Was it last week or the week before? Anyway, my time goes. And he was saying how Harry Strang's absolute favourite musician was the great Louis Armstrong. So this one is for you.
Hello, Dolly, this is Louis. Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly, I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying, but the band's playing our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas, find an empty lap, fellas, Dolly, never go away again.
the band is playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So, golly gee, fellas, have a little faith in me, fellas. Golly, never go away, promise. Never go away, darling. Never go away again.
All right, hands up. Who was playing the air trombone there? I think I was, yeah. Yeah. So that's Hello Dolly by Louis Armstrong, and that would have been one of the tunes that the Harry Strangbang would have played at the Town Hall in St Kilda Dances. Yeah, yeah. A few weeks ago, we had the absolute pleasure of interviewing Terry McTavish, who talked to us about theatre in Dunedin, growing up in the theatre, really, her mother, and teaching drama at Queen's High School. Wonderful conversation we had. We had to divide it up into four because it was, we could have gone on for days, honestly. So this today is part three. Enjoy this one from Terry McTavish.
But I had just missed the first year of The Fortune. In my second year of teaching, 73, when Huntley, David, Murray and Alex decided to put together their premise for The Fortune, and they came to me and auditioned me and said, would I like to be, you know, the woman? Because after all, this was the 70s and we were being feminist, weren't we? And they said, right, well, we'd like you to be in the first play, which is going to be a tryout. Now, you'll see in your records that The Fortune began in 74, but it didn't. It really began in 73 with the performance I was in at the Globe Theatre.
Oh, was it the Globe?
Because Patrick Carey very kindly said to them, and I mean, Murray had, I'd acted with Murray in The Exiles at the Globe, which was James Joyce, which Patrick, of course, loved. Mm-hmm. And Murray was, excuse me, fantastic in it. And I loved being in that, but I did an Irish accent. And they put on a play in 3 weeks rehearsal.
Good
so
grief.
It would just be like a professional theatre.
Yes.
So that was the idea, to see if we could do it, to see if we could get a play to professional standard with that turnover.
Mm-hmm.
And it was The Philanthropist by Christopher Hampton, and I played the lead in that. Huntley had to step in. Huntley directed it, Huntley Elliott. He had to step in and take a part in it because I think somebody dropped out or couldn't manage it or something. I'm thinking Walter Bloomfield might have been the lead, but I could be wrong on that. I remember my first line for that too. It's a very, very exciting opening for a play, the most dramatic you'll ever see. A man is reading his manuscript to two people. One is the philanthropist, a nice friendly, I think he's an English lecturer, he's somebody in the literary world anyway, and another man is reading his manuscript, this playwright, and he comes to the end as the play begins, and the chap says, "Well, you know, I mean, you know, it's nice and everything, but I just don't feel it's very credible. I mean, you know, the ending that you've got with the chap committing suicide like that just because his work's rejected, it's not very plausible." And of course, the playwright says, "You mean he wouldn't do this?" And pulls out a gun, puts it in his mouth, pulls the trigger, and oh, it was spectacular. We had in The Fortune a pipe running underneath the chair the man was sitting on, and it was filled up with tomato sauce and cottage cheese, which looks like brains if you just do it right. Somebody goes, makes a pump behind, and this disgusting mixture explodes up and appears to come right from the guy's brain onto the Picasso print on the wall behind him. There's a blackout, you know, after the bang. And the audience all sort of, to a man, went, "Shit." And my character comes on, I remember saying, "Oh, it's all very well for you to laugh. You didn't have to clean him up. Philip had to throw away his Picasso, didn't he? His brains were all over the place." My character was delightful, she was.
That's the anyway, best start to a play I've ever heard of. Imagine how shocking that would be.
It was a wonderful opening. I'd like to see The Philanthropist again, I must say. It would be rather enjoyable. And oleaginous was my word in that. I mean, I didn't practice that one. Lovely word, oleaginous, isn't it? Anyway, I loved being in that, and I got a good review, and the whole thing got a good review, excepting for Huntley, where they pointed out that it probably wasn't a good idea to be directing and acting it at the same time, because one of them has to suffer a little bit, you know. He didn't have quite as much. But his wife, Shirley, was in that too. Shirley Griffiths, I think she was. I remember him rather cruelly saying to her, "Well, you can't play a vamp. We'll have to play you as a Dolly Bird type." Like, oh God, just give me an act. He could be pretty harsh.
Yeah,
pretty harsh in their attitudes. Some of those directors, I didn't think they were rather the bee's knees. Anyway, obviously, therefore, I wasn't there for the next year when the Fortune moved into the Athenaeum.
That's right.
But as soon as I got back from overseas, they wrote me in, and I think I was in three productions that first year.
Goodness.
Trying to remember which. I think the first one was Old Times. With lovely Ross Johnson again and Sandra Burt, who was a television personality as well, and had also been at school with me. She and Scylla and I all played Viola in Twelfth Night at different times. And we're all taught by Brenda Saville and probably Bessie Thompson, come to think of it. But that was, let me think, Old Times by Pinter. And I was far too young, so was Ross. So that's why later, more than 20 years later, Ross and I prevailed on Lisa Warrington to direct us in it again.
Right.
And we put it on at the Globe.
Yes.
And by that time we understood the play.
You were ready.
We didn't do a bad job, but we were too young to really understand it. It's about memory and the choices that you make when you're young and how you revisit them when you're older and think, what if? And whether your memories are accurate at all when you compare them with other people's. It was a very interesting play, and I liked being in it. We did that in the Athenaeum. And, of course, it was tricky because you had to hide in the library alongside while you were waiting to make your entrance, and you had the audience kind of walking through, and you had to duck and dive. And it was a very little theatre.
Yes.
But it was...
Did they have changing rooms and that sort of thing?
Upstairs. We had to go out through the Athenaeum, and you ran up some... I don't even know where they'd be now. Up in some rabbit warren place up above.
Right.
And it wasn't easy. I remember one night, because it was Pinter, we missed a bit of a chunk. I blame Ross. He skipped something. And I remember a couple of friends of mine coming and knocking on the door afterwards saying, "We've come for the rest of the play." They'd been there on opening night and they noticed something had disappeared, but nobody else did, and the director was in the audience that night. That's Pinter for you. Yeah. There was another night when Ross's baby was being born, and he was in a terrible rush to get to the hospital, so he said, "Right, we're cutting the pauses tonight." Well, if you know Pinter, it's all about the pauses.
Yeah.
We took the pauses out. It was half an hour shorter, but he got to
Different
the hospital
play.
In time for the birth of his baby. It's one of my favourite theatre ones, because it's perfectly true.
Yeah.
And we did The Country Wife that year, and I did another Importance of Being Earnest that year. That's the one with the beautiful hat. Murray could do anything with costume. He designed the most gorgeous costumes for The Importance of Being Earnest. They were all black and white and grey and silver.
Oh,
and it
gorgeous.
Was elegant as. It was just gorgeous. And Evelyn Skinner was Cicely. We had a lot of fun on that. And Barry Dorking played old Chasuble. He was very sweet. I always remember the compliments. Barry said to me, "I fell in love with you all over again every night as Gwendolyn when you made your entrance." "I am always smart, am I not, Mr. Worthing?" You're quite perfect, Miss Fairfax, though I hope I'm not that. It would leave no room for developments, and I intend to develop in many directions.
Oh,
it was fun.
So
it was fun. It was fun. Anyway, that was a good year. Next year was The Three Sisters, and for that they thought, oh, the Athenaeum's just too small. And so we did it in The Regent, and I have to say The Regent is not the place for doing Chekhov, which needs to be intimate and realistic Stanislavski style. Now, Scylla was in that with me, and lovely Sarah Delahunty, and we were the three sisters, and Elric Hooper, professional who ran the Court Theatre for a long time in Christchurch, he played our brother, and Caroline Claver was the hussy that he marries, who turns the tables on us, but it was Jan Prettyjohns, who later produced Shortland Street for a long time. She was our director. She came down from North. They would often employ somebody from outside to come in to direct.
So it was a company, but they had sort of visiting directors.
Yeah, I remember Scylla was with Ralph Hottery at the time. I remember standing up with Ralph upstairs trying to imagine how we were going to project and fill the theatre. It was We need a venue in Dunedin that is about the 200-seater mark.
Yes.
Because that's the audience you can get in and still feel close and intimate with. We've got three at least, Playhouse, Athenaeum, Globe, that'll take around the 100 mark. Mm. But that's not enough to sustain professional theatre. Where even the Mayfair at 400 is a wee bit too big to get people, you know, to fill it every night. Mm. I'd be very interested to see what ends up happening, but I wish they'd get together. It is so sad we've lost professional theatre here. It really is.
What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it would be better to use something that's in existence or to build?
I don't know. Lara McGregor, who was really one of the most wonderful theatre directors we've ever had here.
Yes, indeed.
I asked her about it once because I thought she'd be the best person to talk about it. Sometimes, because I'm a reviewer, they ask me for my opinion as if I'm an expert, which is very, very worrying because I'm so not. But Lara said, well, really, the fortune, much as we loved it, that beautiful old church building, a Methodist lot, it really wasn't fit for purpose. No. It was too difficult for the disabled. The toilet setup was not good. And having performed there, I know the dressing rooms were, you know, it sort of felt fairly unhealthy and damp and mildewy, and it was difficult having to sort of run up the stairs to the stage, although not impossible. This has been worse, it's been worse. The Regent wasn't an easy one to work from for dressing rooms either. And the Mayfair, my God, that's a rabbit warren and a right death trap underneath, if you ask me. It would be nice. Lara did like the idea of a purpose-built place. And, of course, for a while there, where they were designing those extraordinary mussel shell-type shapes on the harbour and thinking one of them could be a theatre, it's a rather exciting idea. But in these days of climate change, my family would not be happy if I did not mention the idea of building something at water level is a bit silly. Anyway, but the fortune, I mean, we could manage, we could support it. And the fact that they panicked and sold that place and the whole thing was shut down. Friends of mine were performing. They were rehearsing in the weekend and they told on Monday that they're not going to be able to do their thing. It was devastating. And not just for the actors, but for all of those people, like Peter King and all those wonderful set builders and lighting people. Mark Nielsen, who was working there as it just makes me so angry to think how fast that all happened and collapsed. We have worked in Dunedin. I've watched us through. We have raised groups that have worked to save the Regent, to save the Mayfair, to save the Globe Theatre. We raised over $500,000 to fix the roof on the Globe Theatre. And how many plays a year is being put on there now? Why isn't there some sort of joint organisation? After the fortune folded, Stage South got together, and that was mostly the professional people and some very good people there working and trying, but it doesn't seem to be working enough as glue to keep in all of the other lots. And I'm afraid we divide off, and the blinking musicians have zipped in there and taken advantage of the theatre people not quite getting their act together, and they've scored a bit more, you know, money and support. Mm. I mean, I know this because my uncle was the Chancellor. The Otago University set money aside to make a little theatre. Back in the 1960s, that little corner, if you know where the gym is, there's a little bare bit of land just that gives onto the street there where you can do parking. Forget the street name. I don't think it's not Dundas, it's next one. Never mind. You kind of know where I mean. It's across behind the gym and on the other side of the road from the old phys ed school building. That space was meant to be the little theatre. That's what they were calling it, and they were going to build one there. They gave it over. See, it would have been like that. And it was in about... It was in the 60s. It was when I was at university. And my uncle laughed away to me that the council of the university had pulled a swifty. They'd let the Students' Association be the ones that controlled the building, that because the students in their ignorance and innocence had put their hands up for it and like, we're not going to have just the lecturers and, you know, the powers that be tell us how to do it, we'll do it. And Hubert said to me, I knew Uncle Hubert said, I knew how it would be. Every 3 years, they all roll over and it's a new bunch.
That's
and they'll
right.
scrap everything done by the ones before and start off again, and it'll never happen. And who never bloody did?
No.
I don't know.
I wonder if they know that.
Theatre people. I love them to bits, but they're not very good at pulling themselves in and organising.
They need a partnership, don't they?
A couple of times when the Fortune as a professional company was operating with a little company, you know, permanent actors, they did it differently. Sometimes they just hire people in for production, and only the people who were running it would be full-time and paid.
Yes.
But they did on a few occasions have a little company that acted as a rep and would be in everything.
Mm.
And a couple of times they asked me, Alex and Murray and Co., if I would come in and be one of those. I must say, every time that I went back to school and said to whatever was the principal of the time, I'd been offered a full-time there, I was promoted at school. I was immediately offered another PR or something. So I think they must have wanted to keep me in the teaching.
Yeah.
But it's just as well I didn't, because, I mean, none of them ever lasted, I'm sorry to say. But that's why I feel guilty about my friends who have been brave and gone through the penniless days and acting crap roles days. Mm. Because they're the ones that have been brave. I haven't. I've just had the good side of it all. Shocking.
But you've inspired the next
generation. I hope so, because otherwise I'm blown if I know what I've done.
There wouldn't be theatre if there weren't more people coming through. So,
well, there is that. I remember how it was that Murray and Alex were really holding that theatre up. They were doing everything. As I said, Murray was fantastic at designing sets and costumes and things. And he had an army of devoted little ladies in South Dunedin and Corstorphine who sewed for him. And I don't think they got paid anything very much again, because he was so charming. He was such a sweetie. Alex threw a bit of a tantrum and said to the board, you know, I'm handing in my resignation, and they accepted it. When he went back again, as you know, knowing Alex, you'd know he would, and said, well, I think I might withdraw my... He was told, sorry, it's been accepted. But mind you, I mean, they didn't find Alex altogether easy to deal with, but they did realise how much work he had done in Murray, because they had to hire three people to do the job that he did.
Oh, goodness.
And of course, that's when it became more and more difficult. I mean, in the outset, I must say, we were being paid, but then most of us would donate our money back to the Fortune in order to help them keep their... Those of us who could afford to. So I used to donate it back again, my salary.
So they went to the Regent?
Only for certain productions, like Macbeth they did there. Ones they thought they could get schools in for, because always is a big help and a money.
So they alternated between the Athenaeum and the Regent. And then when did they go to the Fortune? Was that the next move?
I'm not sure what year that would have been. You probably got it somewhere in your year. I wouldn't like to say. They were very lucky that my mum's great friend, Louise Petherbridge, came back to Dunedin after having been 20-odd years in professional theatre in Britain. She came back to Dunedin just as when I was going off for my OE, and she was in, I think, their first production, it may have been their second one, in the Athenaeum, which was Catherine Mansfield's The Two Tigers.
Oh, gosh,
do you know, that was such a success. They had people queuing right round the Octagon out, you know, onto George Street and they did wonderfully well. Ian Ralston played Mansfield's husband, and I know that Louise has got lovely stories about this, and she'd love to talk to you sometime. But I'll tell you, because she'll tell you this story right away, because I must tell you that she was taking that so seriously that when she had to cough blood as Catherine Mansfield, she had her own blood drawn off from her every day and put into a capsule so that it would be her own blood she was coughing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so much that she was wanting to be authentic and use her own blood. It was partly because there was no such thing as stage blood that would wash out of her white shirt for the next performance, you know, or ever, really. It would just, their stuff, real blood washes out. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Anyway, Lou took that very seriously, and, you know, she set the standard, and I would say again, far more than my own endeavours, I'd like to point to people like Louise. The Fortune was very lucky that she was returned to New Zealand, because it meant that they had somebody whose standard was unquestionably international.
Set the bar.
Louise's husband, Edward Petherbridge, he was the co-director, along with Sir Ian McKellen, of one of the companies at the National Theatre in London, as well as being an actor. If he'd been cast as Gandalf, you shall not pass, their futures would have been reversed on that one. You know, he was just as fine an actor. But, Louise, if she'd stayed on in England, she would have been taking wonderful roles.
So like we were
lucky to have her here. Mm. And it meant that they could put on certain plays that she would be great in, and also that she would set a standard and be teaching the younger members of the company, because that's what repertory did.
Yes.
Pre-drama schools.
That's right.
You learned from watching the people who knew what they were doing. Mm. You stood in the wings and you watched them perform. Of course it was. Mm. And you did the little, your carriage awaits without, the Queen, my Lord, is dead, until you got your moment, you know?
Yeah.
So they've been lucky with that.
Yeah.
And we did things at the Fortune too as part of the Dunedin Dance Theatre, like Orlando.
Yeah.
But for me, I came back again with Campbell Thomas for Revenge's Tragedy, and that was wonderful. And that had Jacob Rajan of Indian Ink playing the lead in that, you know. And wonderful costumes done. I'll show you before you go out. I bought the illustration done for my costume as the Wicked Duchess. Yes. That was great fun. And that was Pamela Mailing from, who was the court's costume designer. She was brought down for that. But it was good that the Fortune and the other professional theatres in the country, they kept the links going strongly. There's different times when the whole mood and morale of professional theatre has been stronger or less strong. I mean, the Fortune, it really 40 years or so.
Yeah,
I mean, there were ups and downs. And and often Roger Hall came to the rescue with a play that would bring the money back in again. Yeah. And, you know, he asked me to write a testimonial for him as an after-dinner speaker once. Got annoyed because I said he was almost always politically correct.
A few things that the feminists weren't too happy about.
But he did some very good things in terms of supporting the Fortune.
Mm, he did. Yeah.
So, you take everything. And you have to judge people on their time, too, very much.
Well, that's right.
Mm, that's right.
But
did you ever act at His Majesty's Theatre?
As a dancer. Mum choreographed a lot of stuff there in the old days. And she used to, in fact, go and... In fact, I think she performed there when she was a little girl before she left when she was 14. They did something there.
Mm.
But I remember she kind of would do the choreography for Murder in the Cathedral. And, of course, for those big operas that I was talking about before, like one that the operatic was trying to do this year, which was the... what's the one, the bat? Fledermaus, Die Fledermaus.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, Mum loved that because she got to do the Viennese waltz that had been the beginnings of her dance studies in Vienna.
Yeah.
And I danced there and some of those things when I was quite young.
Oh, lovely.
And it was wonderful, yeah. Mm. But His Majesty's was beginning to get run down. Mm. It would be nice seeing it revived again. Yeah. And, of course, I went there a lot with Mum to review things.
Mm.
And those were the days when theatre was a bit more glamorous. Mm. I mean, when I started reviewing, I must say it was really nice at the Fortune to be met when I came in with a glass of bubbly and treated with a little bit of respect. We reviewers miss those days. Professional theatre, sadly.
What was it like being a reviewer in such a small city? Is it because you're so part of the fabric?
I know.
Is it hard?
Not entirely. I mean, one of the things... is that the people who are my friends because I admire their talents.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I'm very unlikely to see somebody on stage who is a terrible actor and want to be friends. Does that sound awful? I don't mean it quite like that.
So you could say horrible things about people you didn't like.
Well, do you know, I don't. Because I've been on the other side, if you look, and I've written many, many reviews, and we've had... Arts Council, Creative New Zealand, has actually had workshops and things and put us up in hotels in Wellington of reviewers to, do courses on reviewing. Oh, I mean, I consider myself a professional reviewer, really.
I did not realise
And I've
that
been, since John Smythe started Theatre View, I have been the Chief Dunedin reviewer. I was one of his, like, his founding people. Yeah. And some nice playwrights have written to say that they've been impressed by my reviews. My dear Renee, who wrote Wednesday to Come, wrote to say, I just want to tell you, Terry, I know such good reviews don't just happen by accident, and I'll tell you what, I am at least 8 hours on every one of my reviews. Because I'm fussy and finicky and stupid. Mm. But also because I do work not to crush people with reviews.
Mm. They're genuinely constructive.
Probably the harshest reviews I've written have not been of Dunedin people, but of visiting acts. And I don't know whether that says that perhaps I feel I can be a bit meaner if I don't have to live with them. But honestly, I've never lied.
Mm.
If somebody is a bit woeful, I'm much more likely just to ignore their performance.
Mm.
My friends always say they know exactly what I'm thinking by the way that I word things. So I don't think I don't fake it.
Mm.
And for instance, I have never said that Lisa Warrington has directed a bad production. Because she hasn't.
She hasn't, no.
And she's a friend of mine because I admire her abilities in the theatre. Did you see how that when I'm saying those three things together? Yeah. Lara McGregor.
Yes.
I think she's fantastic. Yes. I can't imagine. I mean, the worst I could do, I used to think the same thing when Keith Harrison would review me because he knew me and liked me and he'd directed me himself. The worst he would do would say, you know, this was not Terry McTavish's best performance. He wouldn't say this woman should never be on a stage. Because I knew he didn't think that underneath. Yes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's a bit the same with me. I can say, and I have said, I don't feel so-and-so was well cast in this role. As a matter of fact, the last productions I saw at the Globe of Glass Menagerie with Kim being very lovely, I kept looking at the two male parts thinking, I would have swapped them around the other way.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing I might say, but I wouldn't say this person is an embarrassment to theatre because...
Well, it's like the school report, isn't it? You can make or break someone with a word or two.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's the same with the plays. But I will... John likes that my reviews are rather personal and that I... Because I contextualise them, I put them in their time and in their place. Mm. So that, I mean, even with the last Fringe coming through, I was referring to the atmosphere in New Zealand with COVID...
Yes.
With our response to Trump, with the war in the Ukraine, I can't not
be
part of it.
Well, it's all
things like the Ukraine. If you've got, you know, that thing I was showing you where you said, oh, I'm glad you've been helping with Ukraine. I never intended to do that. I was just going along because I believe in protests for peace.
Mm.
But then you find that the people who are there because it is their cause, not because they know anything about how to run a protest or a demonstration, and you find yourself being pushed forward because perhaps as a teacher as well as a theatre person you're used to trying to pull things together and make a coherent sense out of it.
And you remember so what you're there for.
That's right. So I ended up at the outset kind of chairing, kind of fronting a lot of those demonstrations. But for 20 weeks now, we've been going down to the Octagon. I've been able to step back from that. The Ukrainian community have learnt how to make an impact, how to do a statement that is theatrical or dramatic.
Lovely Terry McTavish there, and we are very much looking forward to speaking to Louise Pethabridge in a future show, so look out for that one. The last part of our interview with Terry McTavish will be next week, so do tune in for that on 105.4 FM, 1575 AM at 11 o'clock on Monday.
She's great, isn't she? Mm. Love listening to her again. So because it's the end of the Kaleidoscope World Exhibition, and winds up on the 24th of September. Here's Kaleidoscope Wheel by The Chills.
As we were floating in space capsule, I look at you, and perhaps you'll smile at me, loving my kaleidoscope wheel. The stars are like a white god's eyes, we smile and lock.
That song.
Me too.
Great title. It's sort of had such long legs, that title, isn't it? Yeah, exhibitions and albums and songs and
Just reminds me of my childhood, Kaleidoscope, just because I used to have one.
Yeah.
So make sure you get along to the Kaleidoscope World Exhibition at the Hocken. Just a few more days left to that. Finishes on the 24th. Fabulous exhibition. They've really done an amazing job on it. So if you have any interest in Dunedin music at all, or Dunedin, in fact, do go along. Yes.
Great collection of record shop bags, too, which I was particularly fond of.
And the artworks are really, really interesting, too.
And as I was walking to work the other day, I was looking at the building on the corner of Cumberland Street and Stewart Street, and it had the A&T Burt sort of logo kind of on the side of it. And I thought, I wonder what was that building, because now it's been renovated again. So Alexander and Thomas Burt, they were plumbers and metal workers and the founders of A&T Burt Limited. So they were both born in Scotland, and then after their father died in 1847, they moved to Australia with their mother and sister in 1859. And then Alexander, in 1861, he joined the gold rush to Otago, but he didn't have success as a miner, but realised that he could make a fortune plying his trade as a plumber. So he called his brother and Thomas to join him, and they set up shop here in Otago. And so In 1865, the firm installed gas lighting for the Dunedin exhibition. They manufactured drinking fountains, equipment for exterminating rabbits. I'm not entirely sure what that is.
Don't ask.
No, probably not great. Pumps and winches, engines for general use, metalwork parts for Dunedin's waterworks project, boilers and machinery for meat preserving plants, and equipment and dredges for the boom on Otago rivers. So then they moved to a bigger premises in Princes Street in 1874. And then by 1900, they had become so big that they had to move, they had opened the building on Cumberland and Stewart Street as well. So Alexander married Janet Crawford and they had 9 children. He died in 1920. And Thomas married Jean Brodie Reed and had 6 children, so he died in 1884. But the company, in 1969, the company moved to Wellington, and then it merged with Steel and Tube Limited in the late 1980s. And various divisions were then sold off, which resulted in the Burt name disappearing from the business world, but not from our streets. So you can still see the manhole covers with the A&T Burt logos on them. And of course, as soon as you think, oh, I wonder where they are, you can't find them. But I did manage to stumble across one just as you come onto the Octagon.
We'll all be walking, looking at our feet and looking at the manhole covers now. But what a great legacy. They've put in a huge amount of Dunedin's infrastructure over
over
the decades.
Yeah.
I wonder if some of that's now being exposed to us when they're opening up the streets. What are they called? The tubes under the ground.
Pipes and stuff.
Pipes, that's the word.
So there's a book by Ellen Kinniston called Rising from the Golden Glow, Dunedin's Legacy of 19th Century Enterprise. And it has fascinating stories all about, you know, the businesses here in Dunedin. So
it's definitely
worth a look at. Yeah,
definitely.
Loads of good stories there.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. Yes. I'm going to head back now to the dance hall days because I've really obsessed with this, and I'm fascinated to find out about all the etiquette and the history of really the dancers. The dancers were so important to Dunedin and the district. Moving on, in the 20s and 30s and onwards, cabaret dancers were advertised in local papers, and they were considered fashionable and relatively informal. So they'd gone from the dance card era to cheek-to-cheek dancing, which brought couples physically closer than ever before. Where jazz music was improvised, dance cards were redundant, meaning couples could dance together the whole night without any expectation that they change partners. Hence, they started to become places where you met your partner and you could get to know them much better. Musical improvisation also allowed dancers to be spontaneous with their steps. Advertisements for cabaret dancers boasted demonstrations of the latest steps. Dance hall games such as Monte Carlo and Lucky Spot, with their promises of prizes, were another way of drawing in the patrons. I love this. At Joe Brown's weekly dance, Dunedin Dance, in October 1936, the couple who won the Monte Carlo scored, wait for it, a first-class return rail ticket to Timaru and 1 week's lodging at a leading Timaru guest house.
Yay! Wow, you can't
go
better than that.
I know. I wouldn't mind going to Timaru myself. Exactly. Despite the austerity of the war years, women did their best to look good, whether for local men or for exotic American servicemen. The Americans brought glamorous sheer stockings, in the absence of which tan dye with a seam of eyeliner up the calf usually had to suffice. And if you couldn't afford tan dye, you can always use tea, of course. I've tried that myself. Don't tell anyone. After the war, from the far north to the deepest south, every newspaper around the country began advertising weekly dances again. It must have been wonderful after that horrible, frightening era to suddenly be able to go out and dance and meet people again. And have the boys back home, of course. Firms and government departments held annual balls, usually hiring a local dance hall, and ball dresses returned to their former glory and hung to the floor with yards of fabric, because, of course, before that they didn't have any fabric, finally you can start making dresses again. Booklets on how to dance and how to host a dance were purchased. Children and adults attended ballroom dancing lessons, and children were taught at school, and as you spoke about last week... forgotten her name, but Miss Wallace was a great teacher at Dunedin. And then moving on, rock and roll saw teachers jiving in couples in a style similar to the jitterbug. The twist changed that, though. Chubby Checker's famous song meant one could now dance alone or with friends of the same sex. You didn't need to wait to be asked. And the wallflowers sighed with relief because everybody could dance. However, that then resulted in a series of letters from teenagers to the social columnists concerned about the behaviour of the opposite sex at Dunedin dances. Here's one in particular. He says, "Dear Uncle Ernest, where two girls are dancing together, brackets the twist, and refuse to split up on the request of literally hundreds of boys, literally hundreds of boys, gosh, they were popular, I, along with many others, consider them to be odd. Believe me, Uncle Ernest, there are many girls in this category in Dunedin." Oh, dear.
Uncle Ernest.
Uncle Ernest, think, saver of many boys' lives, yes. And then by 1967, 6 o'clock closing ended and pubs remained open longer until 10 p.m. And the band shifted to the pubs. And with them, so did the punters, and dance halls took a dive.
That's quite sad, really, isn't it?
Quite sad. Yeah. I quite like to bring them back again, really.
Yeah. I remember my sister going to disco dancing lessons in Alexandra.
Very cool.
Showing us how to dance.
To learn disco dancing. Oh, I thought you could
do it right.
Oh, I suppose it's all choreographed in a way.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway, as usual, we run out of time. Let's invite you to come back again next Monday, as I said, 11 o'clock, Mondays, 105.4 FM, 1575 AM. You can hear the show again because it's repeated on a Tuesday night at 10 o'clock on the same frequencies. Or you can go to Otago Access Radio's website, oar.org.nz, and you'll find all the podcasts there. Just look up Recollections Radio alongside all the other wonderful podcasts from this show, this radio station. So many to choose from. So do listen. I think that's probably all we've got time for, isn't it?
Yeah.
We better play a song, I think, just to finish.
Another Dunedin band. So here's Made Up in Blue by the Bats.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.